absolutely agree that a lot of our work also needs to be making sure that the U.S. is not just outsourcing a lot of the same policies and tactics to other parts of the world.
Well, finally, even as the internet connects us in many ways, there's still this sort of atomism in modern U.S. life. And we're inundated with this notion that, to put it very crudely, success means starting your own thing, inventing something new and selling it. And that whole mindset works against the collective action that we need so much now and that we know works. Detention Watch Network, as the name suggests, is a coalition. And that formation shapes the work. And that seems very much like a way forward. It's less media friendly, you know, so many voices, so many groups, who do we quote? But that kind of work, coalitional work, is really where we need to be, don't you think?
For so many years, it's been organizers and lawyers, people who are detained, their family members, policy folks in D.C., all of them coming together. And we've actually won a lot of our campaigns in the last many years. Some 20 detention centers are no longer in use because of local and state and federal level campaigns to stop their use. And a lot of that is because a lot of different people from different sectors came together and ordinary people in their communities who said, no, we don't want this. And so I think that's absolutely true. There is no single way. And I'm so grateful to all the people who are doing litigation to stop those executive orders right now. And I also know that ICE already has the tools it needs to target people. And so we have to do work at all the different levels and make sure we're doing everything we can to protect communities. We also saw recently that ICE finally started putting out announcements about how they're going to expand detention. They're saying they're going to build 4 new 10,000 bed facilities, which is just absolutely unheard of. Wow. But, you know, we're doing the work to research that, figure that out, and do everything we can to block those. And we blocked it before, and I think we can do it again. And so just holding on to that sort of spirit of resistance and knowing that this is going to be a tough time, but also there's a lot of people who are ready to do the work and to make sure we can protect our communities as much as possible.
We've been speaking with Silke Shah, Executive Director at Detention Watch Network. Follow their work online at detentionwatchnetwork.org. Silke Shah, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website's also the place to show support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, while the New York Times rolls out claptrap about how both the left and the right have ideas about causes behind the devastating Los Angeles wildfires, the right, you see, blame DEI hires while the left blame climate change. Many people have moved beyond that sort of stultifying nonsense to work that directly confronts the fossil fuel companies and their political enablers for the obvious role that fossil fuels play in climate disruption and that climate disruption plays in extreme weather events. Many are also now calling out insurance companies that take folks' money but then hinder their ability to come out from under when these predictable and predicted crises occur. Would you be surprised to hear that these powerful industries, fossil fuels and insurers, are intertwined? We talked about it last year with writer and historian Derek Seidman. We'll hear that conversation on today's show. Also on the show, did you see the coverage of how people with disabilities are dealing with California fire's impact? Probably not, given that the place of people with disabilities in elite news media coverage.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's a slippery slope when we think it's okay to suspend the Constitution of the United States in order to make a political point or statement.
As the Trump administration ramps up immigration raids across the country, cities are pushing back. We'll go to Newark, New Jersey, and Chicago, then to the Congo, where Rwandan-backed M23 fighters have entered the eastern Congolese city of Goma.
Le peuple congolais ne cédera ni à la résignation ni à l'injustice.
The Congolese people will not cede to this injustice. We will continue to defend our rights, protect our territory, and demand respect and sovereignty. History will judge the world's response to this call.
We'll also look at the civil war in Sudan, where a drone struck a hospital Friday, killing at least 70 people. And finally, Holocaust survivors mark 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll speak to the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar Roz Siegel about Gaza and his latest article, Genocide Denial in Holocaust Studies. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department Monday fired over a dozen officials who work with Special Counsel Jack Smith on now-dismissed criminal investigations into Donald Trump. Acting Attorney General James McHenry said they could not be trusted to faithfully implement Trump's agenda. Meanwhile, Ed Martin, the interim Trump-appointed U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., launched an investigation into prosecutors who brought obstruction charges against some 250 January 6th Capitol rioters. Those charges ended up being tossed after a Supreme Court ruling last year. In related news, the Justice Department has removed a database from its website, which detailed crimes and convictions from the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Workers at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been ordered to stop working with the World Health Organization immediately. The hasty directive came as a surprise to CDC workers, many of whom are working on crucial public health projects aimed at preventing major outbreaks of Marburg virus, Mpox, and bird flu. Trump's day one executive order withdrawing the U.S. from the WHO requires a one-year notice, the approval of Congress, and for the U.S. to still fulfill its financial commitment for the fiscal year. On Monday, President Trump signed four executive orders aimed at reshaping the military, including reinstating 8,000 military members who were relieved of duty for refusing to get a COVID-19 vaccine. He also issued an order banning DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, from the military, in order to build a missile defense system modeled on Israel's Iron Dome, and in order to review the Pentagon's policy on transgender military members in what's believed to be the first step towards a ban on transgender military members. The acting head of the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, issued an agency memo ordering a pause to federal aid, including grants and loans, but exempting Medicaid and Social Security benefits. According to the leaked memo, the pause includes, quote, financial assistance for foreign aid, non-governmental organizations, DEI, woke gender ideology, and the Green New Deal, unquote. Senator Patty Murray and Congressmember Rosa DeLauro, top Democratic members of their respective appropriations committees, said in a letter to the OMB, quote, "The scope of what you're ordering is breathtaking, unprecedented, and will have devastating consequences across the country," unquote. The Navajo Nation reports at least 15 Native Americans in Arizona and New Mexico have been stopped by immigration officers at their homes and workplaces over the past week and asked to produce proof of citizenship. The stops came as President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said he plans to continue immigration raids without apology. ICE says it arrested 1,179 people on Sunday, the largest number ever on a single day by either Trump administration. Over the weekend, Homan and other administration officials visited Chicago to personally oversee ICE raids that have terrorized immigrant communities. His visit came after Chicago Public Schools said they would not cooperate with ICE's plans to conduct raids at schools. At least seven other major public school districts across the U.S. have issued similar statements. We'll go to Chicago after headlines. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum says Mexico has received 4,000 deportees from the U.S. since Trump took office and that non-Mexican citizens were among those deported. That's a reversal from Sheinbaum's position last Friday when her administration refused to allow a U.S. deportation flight to land in Mexico. On Monday, President Sheinbaum said Central American nations could soon reach similar agreements with the U.S. to accept deportees from other countries.
We're in a permanent dialogue, as they are with Central American countries. So it's not that we already have a fully defined coordination, but we're in dialogue, which is fundamental and very important.
The New York Times reports Department of Homeland Security officials have halted a range of programs that allowed immigrants to settle in the United States temporarily, including asylum seekers from Cuba, Haiti, and Venezuela. The Trump administration's also paused Uniting for Ukraine, a Biden-era program allowing Ukrainians with financial sponsors to enter the United States temporarily. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, intense fighting is continuing between M23 soldiers and government forces after the M23 captured parts of the key city of Goma, the capital of North Kivu. The Congolese government said bombs are being dropped on hospitals and camps for displaced people with the goal of terrorizing local populations. Hospitals are overwhelmed. Residents are fleeing Goma in their thousands. France is pushing for a UN Security Council resolution explicitly naming Rwanda as the backer of the M23 forces, an assessment backed by the UN and many countries, including the U.S. Protests have erupted across the DRC, including in the capital, Kinshasa, where demonstrations took place on college campuses and in front of the U.S., French, Ugandan, Kenyan, and Rwandan embassies, nations accused of complicity in the protracted and devastating conflict in the DRC. A coalition of civil society groups gathered Monday in Bukavu, in eastern Congo, decrying the UN Security Council's failure to issue a binding resolution a day earlier.
Despite calls for a ceasefire and the immediate withdrawal of Rwandan troops from Congolese soil, the troops continue to advance. The humanitarian situation is catastrophic and concerning, as thousands of displaced people fleeing the conflict are facing an unprecedented crisis.
We'll have more on the unfolding crisis in the Democratic Republic of the Congo with the chief Africa correspondent Declan Walsh later in the broadcast. Israel's military has carried out fresh airstrikes on Gaza, killing two Palestinians, including a child, despite the ceasefire agreement signed with Hamas earlier this month. Five-year-old Najah Mohammed Al-Amoudi was killed, three others wounded Monday, when the Israeli army shelled a horse cart near the Nusayrat refugee camp. Separately, a Palestinian man was killed, several others wounded, when Israeli forces bombed a bulldozer in Nusayrat. Israel's violations of the ceasefire came as tens of thousands of Palestinians continue to march north along Gaza's coastline to return to the ruins of their former neighborhoods left devastated by Israel's 15-month-long assault. Gaza officials say more than 300,000 people crossed into northern Gaza in the 9 days since the ceasefire took effect. Amidst the devastated landscape were scenes of overwhelming emotion as family members reunited, many of them after being separated for over a year. This is Mohammed Albi, who reunited with his parents and brother in Gaza City Monday.
Better than the whole world. It is a great victory to see my mother, father, and brother. Praise to God. I have been away from them for 1 year and 4 months. I was alone in the north here. They were all in the south.
Praise to God. He brought us back safe and sound. Our Lord gave us victory. May God reassure us about all the Muslims in the world. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds.
Press freedom groups are demanding an investigation and full accountability following the murder of Mexican journalist Alejandro Gallegos, whose body was found in Tabasco State this weekend. Gallegos ran the news site La Voz del Pueblo, the voice of the people. His loved ones and colleagues gathered for his funeral Sunday.
It's hard not to mix politics with day-to-day life, especially in a state such as Tabasco, where we breathe politics. We need our government to get involved in taking actions that provide safety. They should do their work. We really need to get from words to actions.
Civil rights groups have announced a boycott of Target stores across the U.S. beginning February 1st after the retail giant said it would end diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives, aimed at promoting and hiring more women and people from protected minority groups. Target's also ending its goal of sourcing products from business owned by people of color, women, LGBTQ plus people, veterans, and people with disabilities. Target follows other major U.S. corporations like Walmart and McDonald's that have recently shut down DEI initiatives that are under attack by President Trump and his allies. Meanwhile, shareholders at Costco have voted down a proposal to end DEI at the big box retail giant. The move drew praise from some civil rights activists, including Reverend Al Sharpton, who led a buy-in at a Costco in Harlem, New York over the weekend. This comes as 18,000 unionized Costco workers in five states have authorized a strike Friday night at midnight unless management agrees to a contract providing better wages, paid family leave, sick time, and limits to workplace surveillance. In more labor news, workers at Philadelphia Whole Foods just voted to become the Amazon-owned grocery chain's first unionized store. The major worker victory came despite Whole Foods management launching a union-busting campaign threatening and intimidating pro-union workers in violation of U.S. labor law. In business news, share prices of U.S. high-tech companies plummeted Monday, wiping out $1.2 trillion in market capitalization after the Chinese startup DeepSeek launched its newest artificial intelligence model, rapidly overtaking ChatGPT as the top free download on Apple's App Store. DeepSeek says its model is far cheaper and efficient to operate than leading AI models from U.S. companies. Shares of chipmaker NVIDIA plummeted by a combined $593 billion Monday, by far the largest ever one-day stock market loss for any company in history. U.S. power, utility, and natural gas companies also saw steep losses Monday as DeepSeek's successes cast doubt on a projected surge in demand for energy-guzzling data centers. And the Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima was freed from detention Monday evening and deported from Switzerland after a three-day ordeal that rights groups and UN experts blasted as a major attack on free speech. Ali Abu Nima is founder of the online news site Electronic Intifada. He was arrested and jailed ahead of a speaking engagement in Zurich. He wrote in a social media post after leaving Switzerland, quote, "My crime? Being a journalist who speaks up for Palestine and against Israel's genocide and settler colonial savagery and those who aid and abet it," Ali Abu Nima wrote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we're going to stay in Chicago. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, says it arrested more than 1,000 people after detaining another 1,000 on Sunday in raids that immigrant communities and their allies say violate the Constitution and are being carried out in retaliation against sanctuary cities. Newly sworn in Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem is in New York City now on an ICE raid that was covered live, and agents have been told to be camera ready. She was live tweeting the raid. Soon we'll go to Newark, where Mayor Ross Baraka denounced a warrantless ICE raid Thursday that detained a U.S. veteran and other U.S. citizens. But we begin today's show in Chicago, where ICE officially launched, quote, enhanced targeted operations Sunday with the TV personality Dr. Phil joining Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, and streaming the immigration raids live by about 10 teams of about 10 federal agents each. Nearly half those arrested Sunday had no criminal record. ICE says collateral arrests will continue as it claims to target people who are dangerous. On Friday, school officials in Chicago refused to allow agents into an elementary school who were actually not ICE agents, but from the U.S. Secret Service. This comes as four Chicago-based immigrant rights groups have sued to stop the raids, and Chicago City Council voted this month not to lift limits on involvement in federal immigration enforcement actions. On Monday, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee launched an investigation of Chicago and several other sanctuary cities. We go right now to Chicago, where we're joined by Dulce Guzman, Executive Director of Alianza America. She's also a recipient of DACA, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Dulce, thank you for joining us. Can you talk about what's happening in your city?
Yes, thank you for inviting me. In the city and surrounding suburbs, there is a lot of palpable fear and anxiety among families. As you just said, there was over 1,100 ICE arrests across the country, and we still don't know about how many of those were from Chicago. What we have heard from families is that many are choosing to stay home. Many are choosing to not send their kids to school. Several businesses are reporting that they're seeing less business people coming in. So there's a lot of fear and anxiety that is spreading for the same reason that we know that ICE is not only targeting people with criminal backgrounds, but they're targeting people that have been here for many years who have not committed any crime, who are our neighbors.
And Dulce, even those that they claim are folks with criminal backgrounds, apparently many are actually minor infractions. There was a report of a man in Waukegan who was picked up by immigration authorities for deportation, who apparently had who'd been in the country for 20 years and had two DUIs, driving under the influence convictions in the past. What about these minor crimes being treated under federal law as aggravated felonies?
Yeah, I think that this administration is trying to make a point about public safety when we know that this is not about public safety. If this really was about public safety and legality, we would not have seen the 1,500 pardons of people that stormed the Capitol and caused violent crimes on police officers. I believe that this is a very high media strategy that's being used to elevate what this administration is trying to push, which is a white supremacist agenda.
And also, Illinois does not permit the detention of people who are subject to potential deportation. So where are the people that ICE is picking up in Chicago and the surrounding areas? Where are they being sent?
As of now, we don't know, but we suspect that they might be going to nearby states like Indiana, where Indiana does allow detention centers.
Dulce, we want to go across the country from Chicago back here on the East Coast to Newark. Dulce Guzman is with Executive Director of Alianza Americas. In Newark, New Jersey, another sanctuary city, which is in a state where nearly one in four residents are foreign-born, nearly half of all children are part of immigrant families. 3 days after President Trump's inauguration, ICE agents raided a seafood depot in Newark without a warrant, taking three people into custody, including a U.S. military veteran. This is the Newark mayor, Ross Baraka, condemning the raids.
It's a slippery slope when we think it's okay to suspend the Constitution of the United States in order to make a political point or statement. And if we allow people to identify us or put us in categories of criminal or any other thing just by the way we look, then we're going back to a time that was very dangerous in this country, specifically for people that looked like me.
For more, we're joined by Amy Torres, executive director of the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice. She was on the ground soon after the raid took place, and you're the largest immigrant group in New Jersey. Talk about what happened. Describe the scene for us in Ironbound, one of the most diverse areas of Newark.
Sure. I mean, I think it's important to understand what the Ironbound is. This has been an immigrant enclave and hub forever, you know, starting with the Portuguese whaling industry, something that is so archaic, it's like outside of our living memory, right? So this is not the sort of like new arrivals, the criminal gangs, all of the things that this administration says that they're targeting. The other thing is that, you know, ICE has called what they're doing across the country targeted enforcement operations. They refuse to call the detention centers camps. They refuse to call deportations anything but expulsions. Now they're refusing to call raids anything but raids, right? But what we're seeing is that ICE officers stormed this workplace. They immediately announced, do you want this announcement in Spanish or Portuguese? If this is a targeted enforcement operation, don't ICE officers know what they're enforcing? Don't they know what languages they're speaking if they're targeting certain people for arrest? And if this is such a targeted enforcement operation, why are U.S. citizens and veterans being interrogated and detained on the spot and having their credentials questioned? I think it's really important above all else to understand what our constitutional rights are.
Did they have a warrant?
They didn't produce a warrant, and subsequently they haven't produced one since. So, look, understanding what our rights are, presidential administrations come and go, right? ICE directives come and go. The Constitution is here to stay, and our constitutional rights are here to stay. And so long as you understand that unless an ICE officer produces a warrant with your name clearly and correctly spelled and signed by a judge, you do not need to answer their questions. If you understand that, you can also develop an analysis that everything that ICE officers do outside of that warrant is a deception tactic. It's a manipulation. Just like they use the theater of fear and panic to intimidate people into giving more information than they should. And that is how ICE operates in our community. They operate, one of their most effective tools is fear and panic.
And Amy, I wanted to ask you about this, the highly publicized nature of these raids, with having reporters and celebrities accompany the raids and having them all filmed, when the reality is that even at the rate of 1,000 arrests a day, that would take the Trump administration in 1 year. They have 365,000 people arrested. It would take them 30 years, even at this rate, to be able to deport all the people they claim they are aiming to deport.
Yeah, well, I think two things. If Dr. Phil can film ICE officers during an arrest, there's no reason that you and I can't either. If you are a bystander and you see ICE in your neighborhood, you see ICE on your block, you take out your phone and you start filming, because if Dr. Phil can do it, you better bet that you can do it too. The other thing to keep in mind is that this is an administration that is built for the billionaire class. This, yes, ICE's current directives are built on racism. It's built on the post-9/11 nationalism that bore Department of Homeland Security to begin with. But this is also a gift to private prison corporations. That's very true here in New Jersey, where the world's largest private prison corporation, CoreCivic, is looking to expand its footprint and to challenge our ban on immigration detention. It's true in Newark, where Geo Group, one of the other largest private prison corporations, is looking to expand here in Newark, New Jersey, and in other cities across the state. So, yes, whether it's 100 arrests today or 1,000 arrests today, it is built on fear, so that if we can't detain people for profit, we are detaining them in the isolation of their own homes. We are segregating them from society. We are making people so fearful that they're withdrawing their kids from school. They're too fearful to see a doctor. They're too fearful to go to their pharmacy. You know, outside of Newark, we had a pharmacy raid in Paterson here in New Jersey just this weekend. And what that does is segregate society so that if
the federal administration can't physically remove you. You are physically removing yourself into a shadow economy, into places where you can't stand up or you don't feel confident standing up for your rights. And I think the important thing for folks to remember who are not from the immigrant community is that what we learned from Newark with the interrogation of a U.S. citizen and the interrogation of a U.S. military veteran is that it's not enough to have the privileged status. Simply existing in the same place as immigrants makes you guilty by association. ICE officers are not going to discriminate on whether you look or sound like a citizen, whether you are able to produce documents that show that you are a citizen or a military veteran. Simply being in proximity to their target, which is immigrant communities, is enough to arrest and detain you too.
Amy Torres, I want to get your response to Democratic Congressmember Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey signing a letter condemning private immigration detention in New Jersey. But he also voted to support the Laken Riley Act, which will fill more ICE jails.
Look, I think a lot of folks have spent time asking immigrant communities, how are you feeling? What does this moment feel like? What are communities saying? I want to know how Josh Gottheimer feels. I want to know how other people, other politicians in power feel, knowing that, you know, Trump was first elected to office nearly 10 years ago. It's been this long that immigrant communities have been telling people in power how we feel. I want to know if they feel shame. I want to know if they feel disgrace. Do they feel guilt? Because I'm tired of talking about how our communities feel. What is our reaction? They know how we feel, but we need to hear from them if they have taken a commitment to public office, if they've taken a commitment to public service. If this is not the hill that they're going to die on, they picked the wrong fight.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Dulce Guzman from Alianza Americas again. Dulce, how have you seen the elected officials in Chicago responding to this crisis, especially considering that Trump's border czar, our home, and has actually said of both the governor and the mayor that they suck, and if they don't, and if they try to impede his work, he could prosecute them.
Mayor Johnson and Governor Pritzker are standing up for immigrants. They're reiterating their commitment to protecting our communities by enforcing our trust laws, enforcing our sanctuary city ordinance here in Chicago. They have been speaking up for our immigrant communities because they know that we belong here. They know that we contribute to our neighborhoods. We help grow our economies. So I think that we've had a very welcoming response both from Mayor Johnson and Governor Pritzker, but we need more elected officials to speak up on our behalf. As Amy was saying, it's not enough for us to be telling people how we feel. We've been doing that for decades. It is a time for us to show up for our neighbors, to speak up about the economic, cultural, and social contributions that immigrant families make to our cities.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, this is an issue we will continue to cover, and we will be doing an interview in Spanish after the show and post it at our Spanish website, which you can link to at democracynow.org. Dulce Guzman, Executive Director of Alianza America, joining us from Chicago, and Amy Torres, Executive Director of the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice. Coming up, we look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, where Rwandan-backed M23 fighters have entered the eastern Congolese city of Goma. And we look at what's happening in Sudan. What does the global gold industry have to do with it? Stay with us.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado y en las multitudes del hombre que yo amo. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el oído que en todo su ancho traba noche y días, grillos y canarios.
Mercedes Sosa, Martillo singing Gracias a la Vida, Thanks to Life. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Fighting is continuing in the eastern city of Goma between Congolese forces and Rwandan-backed M23 fighters who've seized at least parts of Goma. The fighting has killed at least 17 people with over 370 injured. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Rwandan forces to immediately withdraw from the DRC and end its support for M23 as fears grow of a wider regional war. On Sunday, Congolese Foreign Minister called the unfolding situation in Congo one of its darkest periods in recent history.
Since January 6, 2025, these illegal forces have intensified their attacks, taking over strategic localities such as Katale, Masisi, displacing millions of civilians and destroying vital infrastructure and committing massive human rights violations. These acts are not only attacks against the people of the Congo, but also against the fundamental principles that govern peaceful coexistence between the nations.
Earlier, UN officials in Geneva said the humanitarian conditions in Goma are worsening. Jens Lack is a spokesperson for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
The humanitarian situation in and around Goma remains extremely worrying. And again this morning, our colleagues in the Democratic Republic of the Congo report heavy small arms fire and mortar fire across the city and the presence of many dead bodies in the streets. We have reports of rapes committed by fighters, looting of property, including of a humanitarian warehouse, and humanitarian and health facilities being hit. Hospitals in Goma are reportedly overwhelmed, struggling to manage the influx of wounded people. Electricity and water supplies are compromised, and yesterday, internet services were cut off, and Goma is still offline this morning.
Earlier today, protests broke out in Kinshasa, the capital of the DRC, outside the embassies of several allies of Rwanda, including France and the United States. To talk more about the Congo, we're joined by Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of Friends of the Congo. Maurice, explain what's happening to a global audience in the DRC.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be with you. First and foremost, global audience have to understand that this is a part of a 30-year war of aggression and plunder by U.S. allies, Rwanda, led by Paul Kagame, and Uganda, led by Yoweri Museveni. And this war of aggression and plunder has been able to continue as a result of the support that they have received from major powers like the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, France. That's in part why you see in Kinshasa today, young people are rising up and protesting at those embassies, at the U.S. embassy, the Ugandan embassy, at the French embassy. And so this is has been ongoing for some time. And it's been ongoing as a result of really three factors, Amy. One is rampant impunity. The Rwandan leader, Paul Kagame, and Yoweri Museveni been able to work in eastern Congo, intervene with impunity. Second, there's been a lack of accountability. And third, there's been a lack of justice. Now, what we've seen over the last few days are flurries of activities on the part of the diplomatic representatives at the UN, at emergency session being called. You have France and UK, United States, all making statements. And they, if you follow their statements, they all say Rwanda must leave. Rwandan soldiers are in the Congo. Rwanda has been an aggressor force against the Congolese people. And they've been saying this for years. That's on one side of the ledger in the words that they've articulated as diplomats. But there hasn't been any actions. There hasn't been any sanctions. There hasn't been any military aid being withheld from the Rwandan government. In fact, Rwanda has been rewarded in the midst of this past 3 years aggression where they've surrounded the city of Goma. The European Union has doled out €20 million in 2023, again in 2024 to the Rwandan government. In addition to that, the European Union has entered into a critical minerals deal with the Rwandan government to get access to critical minerals. And as the Rwandan forces, the UN said there are about 4,000 forces in the Congo, and the M23 capture territory, they capture the largest coltan mine in the Congo, in Rubio. Rwanda is listed as the number one producer of coltan in the world. So here it is that it's clearly evident that minerals are being smuggled out of Congo through Rwanda into the international market, and Rwanda is being rewarded for its aggression against the Congolese people, which, as you laid out in the introduction, the humanitarian outfall is catastrophic for the people. I was in the displacement camps a few months ago, and people are living in bestial condition. What we see unfolding in the Congo is really a scar in the conscience of humanity, and it's unnecessary, right?
Maurice,
it's absolutely unnecessary. So the international community can do. Yes.
Maurice Carney, I wanted to ask you, first of all, the significance of the apparent seizure of at least parts or all of Goma, a city of more than 3 million people, bigger than the city of Chicago, suddenly falling under the military forces of Rwanda.
It's important, one, to remind your viewing audience that this is not the first time this has happened. In 2012, Rwanda, back in the M23 and having its forces in the Congo, they seized Goma. At that time, what President Obama did, he called Paul Kagame on the phone and told him basically back off. But in addition to that, he withheld military aid. That's what the United States did. Not a lot, $200,000. However, what that did is it showed some kind of leadership. And then the European nations followed suit and withheld tens of millions of dollars. In addition to that, the UN strengthened its mandate, where it called for a force intervention brigade, where South Africa and Malawi and Tanzania all went in to confront the Rwandan forces and their M23. So this is the one point. It's not the first time this has happened. So we see Paul Kagame being a repeat offender. And with his capturing the city of Goma, or attempting to capture the city of Goma, we had a message from one of our partners on the ground this morning. And he basically said that, you know, I hear gunfire, there are bullets coming through my door. I can't go outside. I have to take cover. Right. Even before that, the women that we work with in one of the largest displacement camps called Bulengo, they had been displaced from the occupation of their villages by the M23 and Rwandan forces, and then displaced right around Goma, and then they're being bombed again. So they had to go in the city. So we really have a catastrophic humanitarian situation unfolding, especially in a tightly knit area as Goma. One high-level official shared with us, you know, that the only place we have left to go is in the lake, right? So the people are trapped in a war that is unnecessary, a war that has been able to continue and be perpetuated because of the lack of action on the part of Western nations, and also because of the rewarding of Paul Kagame in spite of the war crimes against humanity, mass atrocities that he's committed. Even a 2010 UN report says that if the Rwandan soldiers, the UN mapping exercise report that came out in 2010, said if Rwandan soldiers are brought to book, you know, to justice, a competent court could try them for crimes of genocide in the Congo. There's just this lack of accountability. This rampant impunity, lack of justice, has enabled this to continue to this day. And we have an opportunity right now to bring an end to that.
As we wrap up, Maurice Carney, the UN peacekeeping mission has been there, what, since 1999, comprising 10,000 troops. In the last 2 days, two peacekeepers from South Africa, one from Uruguay, were killed, 11 injured. Can you talk about the significance of this and what you want to see happen as the UN calls Security Council meetings around the DRC?
Yes, UN peacekeepers are there with the South African troops, the Congolese troops. In fact, 9 South Africans have lost their lives. 3 Malawians have lost their lives. What is interesting, Amy, Rwanda is the largest contributor to peacekeepers, to the UN peacekeeping efforts in Africa. Yet, in the Congo, they're firing surface-to-air missiles at the UN. So that they're at war against the United Nations. So really what needs to happen is just stronger action on the part of the Western nations. They can do that. 40% of Rwanda's budget comes from the West. Congo is so critical. It's a vital country to Africa, but to the world at large. It's a part of the second largest rainforest in the world. Sequesters more carbon than all the tropical rainforests combined. Therefore, it's vital in combating the climate crisis. And at the same time, it's indispensable to the green energy transition. Producing 70% of the world's cobalt. Cobalt is a central ingredient that's necessary for the batteries that power the electric vehicles and the green transition. So Congo is at the nexus of two major global phenomena. Combating the climate crisis, making a green energy transition. So it's of interest to all of us to be engaged, to raise awareness, to hold our leaders accountable. So we should be calling on the UN to do more, calling on the European Union to cancel its contracts with Rwanda, calling on France, where France, Emmanuel Macron, has been blocking action, calling on Macron to stop blocking actions. So Congolese are demonstrating in Kinshasa. They're demonstrating today at the UN. We'll be demonstrating at the Rwandan embassy this coming weekend on Saturday. So people have to raise their voices, demonstrate, hold their leaders accountable, write letters, do everything that they can to assure that there's an immediate ceasefire, that Rwanda withdraws its troops from the Congo, the M23 demobilizes, and Congo restores the integrity of its state. It's almost right now, Rwanda and the M23 occupy in Congo almost land area almost the size of Rwanda itself.
Maurice Carney, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and executive director of Friends of the Congo, joining us from Mexico. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Sudan. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres renewed his call for an immediate halt to the fighting between the Sudanese military and paramilitary rapid support forces. Guterres also condemned last week's drone attack on the last functioning hospital in the besieged city of El Fasher in North Darfur. The attack killed an estimated 70 people. Sudan's government blamed the RSF for the massacre. Over 14 million people have been displaced by the war in Sudan, which started in April of 2023. 3 million of those have become refugees, most of them crossing the border to South Sudan and Chad. We go now to Declan Walsh, chief Africa correspondent for the New York Times, based in Nairobi, Kenya. Last month, he wrote a piece headlined, "The Gold Rush at the Heart of a Civil War." Declan, thanks so much for being with us. Explain why gold is so essential to what the U.S. is now in Sudan calling a genocide, even.
Thanks, Amy. It's great to be with you. Look, it's really the most astonishing thing in this huge war. The war has been going on for 2 years. It has destroyed the country, pushed it into famine. It has just absolutely crushed the economy. And yet the one thing that is still functioning, in fact, the one business that's still thriving, is gold. Sudan has some of the richest gold deposits in Africa. And since the war has started, our reporting showed that both sides have stepped up their efforts to exploit that gold, most of which ends up being traded in the United Arab Emirates and the Gulf. And they're using that funding to fund the weapons purchases that are being used to fight the war.
And Declan, could you talk about the role of the United Arab Emirates in this conflict?
So one of the aspects of this conflict that have really bedeviled efforts to try and bring the two warring sides to peace is the fact that so many foreign countries have gotten involved on both sides. But far and away, the most significant meddlesome foreign power, if you like, is the United Arab Emirates. Our reporting and reporting by other outlets has shown that they have been smuggling weapons across the border into Sudan to the Rapid Support Forces. That's the paramilitary group that the U.S. has now determined committed genocide during the war. They've been smuggling those weapons for about the last 18 months. And it's become, certainly in the last months of the Biden administration, it had become quite a sensitive point between the two countries. Biden administration officials up to Vice President Harris had raised this issue in private with the Emiratis, asking them to stop the support for the RSF. There's a certain degree of support in Congress. Some lawmakers have introduced laws, or had it proposed laws rather, suggesting that the US should condition weapons sales to the Emirates so that it would stop supporting the RSF. But in public, the Biden administration was actually, I would say, much more supportive of the Emiratis. The Emiratis, of course, is an incredibly wealthy country with a lot of money to invest. It buys a lot of American weapons. And so that support has continued. Just last Friday, as news was coming through of the drone strike that you referenced in the introduction there, that killed about 70 people at a hospital in Darfur, we had a word from some lawmakers in Washington who said that they had been informed officially by the Biden administration that despite the promises by the Emiratis that they would stop funding or arming the RSF, that arming continues to this day.
And what is the reason, the purpose of the Emiratis in their support of the RSF?
Well, it should be said the Emiratis absolutely deny that they've consistently denied that they provide any support to the RSF. But as we know, you know, Sudan is a country with immense natural resources, not just gold, but it also has immense agricultural potential, a lot of agricultural land along the Nile that is coveted or desirable to many Gulf countries that are facing a future where their own food security could be in doubt. But it's also a very strategic place. It has a long coastline along the Red Sea, and there are many countries that are jostling in the hope, including Russia, that hope that they may at some point be able to set up a port along that. And frankly, the other reason is just because the Emirates can. The Emirates has a long-standing relationship with the Rapid Support Forces and with its leader, General Mohammed Hamdan, that goes back to the campaign that the UAE waged along with Saudi Arabia in Yemen some years ago. As part of that campaign, the Emirates paid for the Rapid Support Forces to send some of its troops to Yemen to fight alongside its own forces. And so there's this long-standing relationship between some of these, the leaders of the Emirates, effectively members of their royal family, and the RSF. And the Emirates appears to have taken a calculation that they thought that he could win this war, but increasingly the RSF has been losing ground on the battlefield, and there's a real question mark over whether, I mean, there's a question mark, frankly, over whether either side can win this war by purely military means.
Declan Walsh, as we wrap up, I wanted to take us on the journey that you begin the gold rush at the heart of a civil war piece with. You say the luxury jet touched down in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, on a mission to collect hundreds of pounds of illicit gold. On board was a representative of a ruthless paramilitary group accused of ethnic cleansing in Sudan's sprawling civil war. The flight manifest showed the gold itself had been smuggled from Darfur, a region of famine and fear in Sudan that's largely under his group's brutal control. Take us from there to UAE, where the gold goes to, and the fact that you interviewed the head of the RSF, back in 2019 when they took over a gold mine, yet minimized its power, though ultimately it fueled the RSF to the power it is today.
Yeah, gold is really at the heart of the RSF's ascent to power. I mean, the RSF endeared itself to the autocratic ruler of Sudan, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, before he was overthrown in 2019. But it also grew incredibly rich by taking over the largest gold mine in the country and by using that money to build a business empire that extended into many businesses. And that's why when I met the leader of the RSF in 2019, I asked him about that. At the time, he tried to downplay it, but our reporting shows just how pervasive it's been. And the incident that you referred to that we reported on in the story was really just an effort to illustrate just one of many, many routes that gold follows when it flows out of Sudan. Sudan's a country that borders about seven other countries. Gold seems to be flowing across almost all of those borders into those countries, and sometimes through very circuitous smuggling routes involving a whole range of officials, not just in Sudan, but in neighboring countries, involving companies, gold traders in the UAE themselves. It ends up in the UAE, where, you know, research has showed about 90% of the gold from across Africa, including many conflict zones like Sudan, ultimately is traded.
Declan Walsh, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Chief Africa correspondent for The New York Times, based in Nairobi, Kenya. We'll link to your pieces on Sudan at democracynow.org, the gold rush at the heart of a civil war. Coming up, Holocaust survivors mark 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll speak to the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar, Raz Siegel. Stay with us.
La 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 ni la ni le ya ya yo ni hu ni le yo 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 ah lo 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 vinay lo 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 ah lo 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 fagonerona lo 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 ani senabni lo 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 senabnunu
adada lullaby by the Sudanese musician Rasha. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Monday, Holocaust survivors and world leaders mark 80 years since the liberation of the Auschwitz Nazi death camp. Events were held in Poland as well as at the United Nations here in New York. This is Holocaust survivor Dumitru Miclescu. Speaking at the United Nations yesterday, at 8 years old, he lost his mother, sister, and two of his brothers at Transnistria death camps.
Death was a daily presence. I saw my mother, my sister, and two of my brothers die. Only a few of us returned home, and when we did, we had nothing left.
A Roma survivor of the Holocaust, the commemoration came 2 days after the tech billionaire Elon Musk took a break from advising Donald Trump Saturday to give a surprise virtual address to the far-right AfD party, or Alternative for Germany. Musk's appearance came just days after he sparked controversy for twice giving a Nazi salute at a Trump inaugural event. Among other things, Musk told attendees it's time to move on from past guilt, an apparent reference to Nazism and the Holocaust, when he was talking to the AfD. For more, we're joined by the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar Raz Siegel, whose new article for Jacobin is headlined Genocide Denial and Holocaust Studies, Associate Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Sockton University, endowed professor in the study of modern genocide. Professor Siegel, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this day yesterday, the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the death camp Auschwitz, and how it relates to what's happening today.
Well, hello, Amy, and thanks for having me on the show again. I think that it was very significant to see a Roma survivor speak yesterday at the UN. I was there with students, but it was also shocking, actually, to see that the rest of the ceremony focused on, you know, what you might call a genocide-generating world of lies, because the main speaker in the ceremony yesterday was Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog, and he came on basically to present Palestinians as Nazis, to present Israel's attack on Palestinians in the frame, basically, of, as he described it himself, the Jewish state defending itself from this ongoing attack, right? Nazis in the past, Palestinians today, rather than the reality, which is a stateless population, Palestinians under decades of Israeli settler colonial rule, under siege, now under genocide in Gaza, and attacked by a very powerful state backed by all the Western powers. And this is a person, of course, Yitzhak Herzog, that back in October 2023 defined all Palestinians in Gaza, as we remember, as responsible for the Hamas attack on Israel, that is, his enemies. In December 2023, he went on to talk about civilization and barbarism, that is, Palestinians and barbarians, and Israel as part of the civilized world. He repeated this discourse yesterday. So it was very shocking to see, you know, on International Holocaust Remembrance Day, the UN, which we have to remember and remind everyone, right? Israel has killed now over 338 workers in this attack, the majority of them UN workers, right? So the institute that Israel has killed so many of its employees, we see this, again, what I call genocide-generating world of lies, right? A world turned upside down where people facing genocide become Nazis, become anti-Semites, and this is all in grotesque, again, display of lies. So this is what happened in the UN. It's important to say that the Roma survivor, which was, again, very remarkable to see, his message was that actually Roma continue to face attacks today, as they do in states across Europe, also states that are committed, allegedly, to Holocaust memory. They continue to face persecution and discrimination. And he called, actually, called out, and he said, you know, help us, you know, end this endless persecution that Roma continue to face still today, right? So he was also talking about the failure of what we call Holocaust memory and education. But then we saw it really in a grotesque way in display with Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog in attendance.
And Raz Siegel, could you talk about, in your Jacobin article, you've described the partnership between Israeli and German Holocaust scholars as troubling. Can you explain how this partnership perpetuates the denial of Israel's genocide in Gaza?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the field of Holocaust studies has always been based just the study of the Holocaust itself. And we have also genocide studies, or what we call Holocaust and genocide studies. But Holocaust studies was also always based on the idea that the Holocaust is unique. And this also meant that Israel, the state of Holocaust survivors, or the state that portrays itself as a state of Holocaust survivors, the Jewish state, is also unique. And this is really at the basis of Nakba denial, right? The idea that Israel cannot perpetrate any crime under international law, let alone genocide. So this was very central also in Holocaust studies always, this kind of protection for Israel from criticism and really the perpetuation of Nakba denial, the denial, right, of the ongoing Nakba as well, the continued assault on Palestinians. And this is what we see today. This is the reason that since October 2023, right, so many Holocaust scholars have actually gone out of their way to protect Israel, to attack other Holocaust and genocide scholars like myself, including many Jews, including Israelis who speak out about Israel's attack on Gaza, who speak on the basis of the mountain of evidence that we have today about Israel's attack on Gaza. But again, it's very grotesque that we see it among Holocaust scholars. I wrote this piece about an event that took place online, organized by the Western Galil College in Israel, where there's a Holocaust program and a strong collaboration between Israeli and German Holocaust scholars. And the whole event was actually designed as an attack against Holocaust and genocide scholars like myself, who speak about Israel's attack on Gaza. We were portrayed as anti-Zionists and therefore anti-Semites, right? So this equation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, but there was also just crude genocide denial. One of the speakers, Verena Busser, for example, who's a German scholar in Berlin that teaches online in Israel in that program, outright said, minimizing the number of Palestinians killed by Israel, saying that there's no starvation. These kinds of outright crude denials that go against all the evidence that we have. But again, we see it in the frame of Holocaust studies now. And this is rooted in the history of this field that it was always based, again, on the idea that Israel is a unique state, right? That Israel cannot perpetrate really any crime under international law, impunity. for Israel and the international legal system, but also in this field. And therefore, we see this kind of denial reproduced today, and we saw it in this event that I wrote about.
Professor, I wanted to just end by asking you about what just happened at the American Historical Association. I saw you a few weeks ago here in New York at the Hilton when members of the group voted overwhelmingly, 428-88, to oppose Scholasticide in Gaza. If you can talk about what happened next. I was talking to a past president of the American Historical Association. They said, oh, I'm sure they're going to have to go along with that vote because it was so overwhelming. But they vetoed it. We have 20 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, the AHA Council unfortunately vetoed this vote. Of course, this is, you know, an insistence on defending Israel at all costs. I think that what we're seeing, of course, is U.S. institutions standing behind the defense of Israel, because if we come to terms with what Israel is doing, which is Israeli settler colonialism, this then means that the settler colonial genie is out of the bottle. We have to talk also about settler colonialism here in the U.S.,
well, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us. Professor Raz Siegel, Israeli-American historian, expert in Holocaust studies. We'll link to your Jacobin piece. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Llevaba mangas de
palabras son más grandes, son bastantes importantes. Cuando hablo, pienso antes, hay que hacerse responsable.
Una cosa por otra, es como confuso, es como pura boca, una promesa rota, palabras que